Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
The UN says gunmen fire on food barges in South Sudan, four are wounded. Ukrainian security forces clash with pro-Russian militants. I'm Frances Alonso reporting from Washington. The United Nations mission in South Sudan says four people were wounded today when gunmen attacked barges bringing supplies to a UN base. This is the second time this month UN operations in South Sudan have been targeted after a mob attack on a UN base in the town of Bor, April 18th. The UN mission says today's attack took place as four barges steamed east on the Nile River, carrying food and fuel to the UN base in Malakal in Upper Nile State, where thousands of civilians have taken refuge from the violence. The mission says spokespersons for both South Sudan's government and rebel forces have denied responsibility. An Afghan security guard today opened fire at an international hospital in Kabul, killing three American doctors. The assailant was shot and wounded by his colleagues and has been hospitalized and is under police custody. Ayaz Ghul has details.
Afghan Interior Ministry officials said the deadly attack occurred when an Afghan security guard opened fire at Kabul's Cure International Hospital. Ministry spokesman Siddiq Siddiqui says the unfortunate incident is under investigation and the assailant's motives have yet to be determined.
The attacker was also shot by the other security guard and he's now under the serious watch of police, but he's now in the hospital. We do not yet know the motives and the reasons behind this attack.
In a brief statement on Twitter, the U.S. Embassy says that with great sadness, we can confirm that three Americans were killed in the attack on Cure Hospital. The shooting is said to have left a fourth U.S. citizen wounded. Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Partial results from Afghanistan's April 5th presidential election show former Foreign Minister Abdullah Abdullah still in the lead, but without a clear majority that would rule out a runoff vote. The commission chairman, the Independent Election Commission chairman, says nearly 83% of the votes have been counted. He told reporters in Kabul that with only 17% of votes left to count, it's doubtful there will be a clear winner and that there's a runoff possible. Final election results are due to be released on May 14th. President Barack Obama has reaffirmed the U.S. treaty commitment to defend Japan, including a group of East China Sea islands claimed both by Tokyo and Beijing. After a meeting today in Tokyo with Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, Mr. Obama explicitly stated the Senkaku Islands fall under the treaty obliging the United States to defend Japan if attacked.
We do not believe that they should be subject to change unilaterally. And what is a consistent part of the alliance is that the treaty covers all territories administered by Japan. So this is not a new position. This is a consistent one. In our discussions, I emphasized with Prime Minister Abe the importance of resolving this issue peacefully.
It is the strongest recent statement of support for Japan by the U.S. president regarding the island dispute, which has seriously damaged relations between Japan and China. Fighting between Ukrainian security forces and pro-Russian militants in eastern Ukraine has left at least five militants dead, with Russian President Vladimir Putin calling Kiev's military moves a crime. Meanwhile, U.S. President Barack Obama, speaking to reporters today in Tokyo, said Russia is not abiding by the Geneva Agreement to ease a crisis in Ukraine and says he is not hopeful the Russians will cooperate. He said Russia has chosen not to take the wise path and faces stronger sanctions.
On the other side, you've seen the government in Kiev take very concrete steps in introducing an amnesty law and offering a whole range of reforms with respect to the Constitution that are consistent with what was discussed in Geneva. My expectation is that if, once again, Russia fails to abide by both the spirit and the letter of what was discussed in Geneva, that there will be further consequences and we will ramp up further sanctions.
You can read more on the president's comments at voanews.com. A plastic, multicolored, multi-layered puzzle cube that has both entertained and frustrated admirers worldwide is celebrating its 40th anniversary. A special exhibition in New Jersey is to honor Erno Rubik for the invention of his toy cube. I'm Frances Alonso, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
At least 20 people are reported dead and thousands have fled Cameroonian villages on the border with Nigeria following a conflict between armed Nigerian cattle ranchers and Cameroon farmers.
That's Moki Edwin Kinzeka reporting from Yaoundé. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also in the news, the outgoing head of the Red Cross delegation in South Sudan expresses surprise at how quickly conditions in the country are deteriorating. Female leaders in Nigeria blame the central government for failing to rescue 230 girls at school that were kidnapped and remain missing, and a revolutionary new drug regimen to treat tuberculosis is advancing. We'll have these stories plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from the DRC, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, top U.S. diplomats say the conflicts in South Sudan and the Central African Republic will compound widespread food shortages and long-term instability. Millions of people in the two countries have been forced to flee their homes because of political, ethnic, and sectarian conflict. From VOA's Southern Africa Bureau, Anita Powell reports on a recent trip to the region by U.S. humanitarian officials.
U.S. officials are sounding the alarm over what they call humanitarian catastrophes in Central African Republic and South Sudan, neighboring African nations that in the past year have been ripped apart by political turmoil and then descended into bloody conflicts. The tragedies in the two nations could not be more different. In the Central African Republic, long troubled by civil strife and coups, Muslim rebels toppled the former president last year. In doing so, they unleashed chaos that turned into deadly violence between Muslims and Christians. South Sudan was supposed to be a success story. In 2011, the people of this landlocked nation voted overwhelmingly to separate from Sudan. Leaders of South Sudan, many of them former rebel fighters, ushered in their independence with jubilant and peaceful celebrations. It didn't last long. In December, the president accused his former deputy of a coup attempt. Their political rift spiraled into armed combat and then detoured into what the United Nations says is ethnic bloodshed. Ann Richard, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Population, Refugees and Migration, described her recent visit to the CAR and to refugee camps in Chad.
Quite frankly, we were shocked by some of the things that we saw. We talked to one gentleman who showed me photos of the mutilated body of his father.
Her deputy, Catherine Wiesner, says the situation in South Sudan is getting worse despite months of intermittent peace talks in Addis Ababa. She says that is why the UN Security Council is considering sanctions against some South Sudanese leaders.
We have been inviting and encouraging and, in fact, I would say pressuring those politicians to come around the table and have that discussion. And that's really been the focus of our diplomatic engagement ever since December. I think it's because we've come to the point where we've seen the violence continuing, the attacks on civilians continuing, the blockages to humanitarian assistance continuing, that we have considered this additional action to increase the pressure.
The U.S. government says it has poured more than $500 million in aid to the two countries since late last year. But humanitarian officials say that money can't do much if armed groups don't allow aid workers to access people in need. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Thank you, Anita. The UN Security Council today issued a unanimous statement expressing horror and anger over the recent killings of hundreds of people in Bentiu, South Sudan. The council is threatening to impose targeted sanctions against those it believes are responsible for the violence. The council has called for an immediate end to all human rights violations and demands the government protect civilians. Also, the outgoing head of the Red Cross delegation in South Sudan is expressing surprise at how quickly conditions in the country are deteriorating. In an interview with VOA, the official warns the humanitarian crisis will become worse as the rainy season takes hold in a couple of weeks. Lisa Schlein reports from ICRC headquarters in Geneva.
Milker Mabek has just left his post as mission chief of the International Committee of the Red Cross in South Sudan, which he assumed in March 2012. At that time, he tells VOA, No one could have predicted the speed, geographical breadth, and ferocity of the crisis that erupted a little more than 4 months ago.
The country is not even 3 years old, and when I arrived 2 years ago, there was so much hope and joy and hopes for the future. It's been very, very sad to see these hopes destroyed in the last couple of months. You see the fear among people of a return to the old days of extended conflict and hardship.
Mabek says it is hard to predict the future, but the situation does not look optimistic. He says fighting between government and rebel forces will likely subside when the rainy season arrives next month, but the rains will pose other extremely difficult problems. He says more than 1 million people will remain displaced inside and outside the country, and reaching them with desperately needed aid will be a monumental challenge.
These people need food, they need shelter, they need clean water, and they need to be able to return to their homes at some point to start working the land again and to start producing food. The planting season has already been severely disrupted by this crisis. We're extremely concerned about the nutritional situation in South Sudan now. If this continues, it's likely to further deteriorate.
The United Nations reports more than 3.7 million people in South Sudan are going hungry. It warns 50,000 severely malnourished children could die by the end of the year if they do not get immediate treatment. Mabek says ICRC mobile surgical teams are deployed in areas affected by fighting and have treated more than 1,200 patients. He says the agency has provided basic needs for almost 200,000 displaced people.
We continue, of course, working on the issues of compliance with humanitarian law. This remains one of our main concerns, and we keep on a dialogue with both parties to the conflict and remind them of their obligations to abide by these very fundamental principles.
The Red Cross message that civilians must not be targeted does not appear to be getting through to the warring parties. The United Nations mission in South Sudan has accused rebels of killing more than 200 civilians last week after seizing the town of Bentiu. A rebel spokesman denied the charge. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thirteen minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. At least 20 people are reported dead and thousands have fled Cameroonian villages on the border with Nigeria following a conflict between armed Nigerian cattle ranchers and Cameroon farmers. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaounde.
Eyewitnesses say hundreds of Fulani herdsmen fleeing conflicts in Nigeria's Taraba and Benue states reacted violently when Cameroon village farmers called for them to leave the area. Cameroonian Member of Parliament Walang Richard tells VOA the Fulani were armed and caught the villages by surprise on Tuesday.
These guys are heavily armed, I repeat it. They have burned down schools, they have burned down houses, they have destroyed crops. It's a disturbing issue.
The villages involved include Efun, Afu, Gayama and Mai, situated about 20 kilometers from the nearest military post. This is not the first violent incident involving Fulani herdsmen who have long been embroiled in conflicts over land rights with regional farmers. In 2012, they raided the village of Bauru. Cameroon's government responded by creating a military post in that village. Walang says more needs to be done to protect citizens in his district. He also says the number of dead is probably higher than what the military initially reported, given that people have been scattered on both sides of the border.
There are so many. There are even some we are looking, we are not seeing. They are taking the thing lightly. It's not something to take lightly. We must secure our border.
Cameroonian soldiers have been deployed along the country's borders to deal with violent spillovers from the conflicts in Nigeria and the Central African Republic. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Well, more than a week after some 230 teenage girls were kidnapped from their schoolhouse, frustration in Nigeria's northeast is deepening. Female leaders blame the central government for failing to rescue the girls as the nation's governors meet with President Goodluck Jonathan to address a growing security crisis. Heather Murdoch reports from Abuja.
More than a week after the girls were kidnapped, authorities say at least 190 are still missing. The dozens that are free escaped on their own, fleeing to safety through the bush. The girls that remain captive are believed to be deep within the Sambisa forest, where Boko Haram Islamist militants are known to hide out. Locals say they know roughly where the girls are, but they don't know how to stay alive long enough in the forest to rescue them. While no one has claimed responsibility for the kidnapping, it's widely believed that Boko Haram is holding the girls as spies, servants, or sex slaves. Dressed in black to show solidarity with grieving families, Aishatu Ngolde, a northern human rights activist, says the federal government's failure to locate the girls is tantamount to complicity in the crime.
Are you telling me that Borno State is so thick that no plane can see the ground? Why is there not been there in Borno over our children? They have been taken. We are born mothers. If it is Joshua's daughter that has been stolen today with the country to live, she would not.
Officials say security forces are using all means at their disposal to rescue the girls. Jan Saint-Pierre, the CEO of Berlin-based security consulting firm Mosicon, says if the Nigerian military launched a direct assault in the forest to rescue the girls, they might kill more girls than they save.
The forests there are really dense. Geography and all the elements that are really hard to really prepare proper operation the way Nigerian army wants to conduct it. And so a full-scale attack that would make them look good and also show strength is simply not feasible. You would end up with many, many more casualties and civilian casualties than you would actually get Boko Haram fighters.
The Nigerian military has been silent in recent days after retracting an initial report that most of the girls had been freed. Saint-Pierre says a rescue would go a long way to improve the image of Nigerian security forces, but it would require negotiations accompanied by precision operations.
For the girls right now, it's finding the proper back channels that would allow for negotiations and that would allow the girls to be freed. They would then save face.
Nigeria has been mired in the Boko Haram insurgency for almost 5 years now, and three northeastern states have been under emergency rule for almost a year. Boko Haram has been blamed for thousands of deaths in attacks on churches, mosques, schools, marketplaces, the government, and most recently, a bus station bombing in the capital that killed 75 people. And things are getting worse, with rights groups saying 1,500 people were killed in the first 3 months of this year alone. Some weeks, attacks are reported every day. Some attacks never get reported. Despite the chaos, Gambo Maman Gesau, another leading northern human rights activist, says the girls will not be forgotten.
Let them release the pure children. Poor children, let them release them. If they are not going to release them, we women in Nigeria, we are going to gather ourselves and march.
Besides air support and resources, female activists in Maiduguri called on Boko Haram militants to negotiate with the government, promising the militants motherly support towards rehabilitating them when the need arises. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. Coming up on 20 Minutes Past the Hour, here's a recap of our top stories. The outgoing head of the Red Cross delegation in South Sudan expresses surprise at how quickly conditions in the country are deteriorating. At least 20 people are reported dead and thousands have fled Cameroonian villages on the border with Nigeria following conflict between armed Nigerian cattle ranchers and Cameroon farmers. And female leaders in Nigeria blame the central government for failing to rescue the kidnapped girls as the nation's governors meet with President Goodluck Jonathan to address a growing security crisis. And of course, we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest, Washington, D.C., 20237. The U.S. is sending 10 Apache helicopters to Egypt to help with counterterrorism efforts. The move is a partial lifting of the ban on military aid that was announced after the military ousted President Mohamed Morsi last year. Also, the State Department says $650 million could be released in the near future for Egypt. That's about half of the $1.5 billion in aid that had been on hold. Congressional approval of documents is needed before those funds are released. The documents would confirm Egypt is meeting its commitment to the Israel Peace Treaty of 1979. Scientists have mapped the genetic code of the tsetse fly, the insect responsible for African sleeping sickness. They say the findings could lead to better repellents and control efforts and boost vaccine research. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The World Health Organization says African sleeping sickness occurs in 36 sub-Saharan countries. The bite of the tsetse fly transmits parasites that could eventually reach the central nervous system, causing confusion, sensory problems, and poor coordination. It also disrupts the sleep cycle, giving the disease its name. The WHO says drug treatment is complex, but without it, the disease is usually fatal. Efforts to control tsetse populations brought the number of new cases below 10,000 for the first time in 2009. In 2012, just over 7,200 new cases were reported. Serap Aksoy is a professor of epidemiology of microbial diseases at the Yale School of Public Health. She and her colleagues in the U.S., Africa, and elsewhere began searching the tsetse fly's DNA for its genetic code 10 years ago. The WHO provided initial funding. In all, the project cost $10 million.
The genetic code is the blueprint of the fly that is responsible for making all the proteins that are involved in all of its functions, essentially. These are involved in every aspect of the fly's essential structure and function. They're basically the parts list that an organism is made from.
African sleeping sickness is the name given when the disease affects people. When found in animals, it's called nagana.
Sleeping sickness, along with nagana, have hindered public health and development of agriculture in Africa for centuries. This is a very neglected disease, and hence limited amounts of research funds have gone into the study of this insect and this disease. So we're really excited that this will be a breakthrough for control.
The genome could help researchers better understand just how functions within the tsetse fly work.
These included, for example, olfaction, which determines smell, what we call gustation, which is taste, vision, reproduction, digestion, blood feeding, immunity, and symbiosis. So these were the kind of things which we felt represented bottlenecks in flies' biology. And as we decoded the genome, we particularly looked for proteins involved in these processes.
Olfaction is important, for example, because one of the best ways to control the flies is with traps. These traps use different scents to attract them.
There are many such traps that have been developed for tsetse flies, but they are not necessarily all efficient at the same rate and not available for some of the important species that transmit the human disease. Scientists can now make better traps that would be more efficient in attracting flies or they can make repellents that may be put on animals, on people.
Axoy says it's not clear whether the research could lead to better treatment drugs, but she says the information could help vaccine development. She adds the research has led to the training of many young African scientists who will further study the tsetse fly genome. Genome research is currently underway for other parasitic diseases, including leishmaniasis, trypanosomiasis, and Chagas. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
A spike in the cases of the deadly Middle East respiratory syndrome in Saudi Arabia has alarmed international health officials, but regionally, authorities are offering few preventative measures for the MERS virus. VOA's Elizabeth Arrett has more from Cairo.
Saudi Arabia announced two more MERS-related deaths and two new infections Thursday, one day after the World Health Organization renewed concerns about the dramatic jump in the number of victims in recent days. Health ministries from Saudi Arabia to Egypt have tried to downplay the threat of Middle East respiratory syndrome. The coronavirus, which proves fatal to about one-third of its victims, first appeared in Saudi Arabia 2 years ago. Saudi officials report nearly 300 people have come down with the disease's pneumonia-like symptoms since then. More than 50 of those cases have been reported in the past week. Regional authorities say there is no cause for alarm or need to impose preventative measures such as travel restrictions. Dr. Amr Kandil, chief of Egypt's health ministry's preventative sector, says his agency has set up screening sites across the country to check suspected cases.
The total sample examined from human cases, it is about 8,500 cases, and all of these samples were negative to the MERS corona.
But Kandil said the probability for a MERS outbreak remains, given frequent travel by Egyptians to Saudi Arabia's religious sites and workers throughout the region. He also notes the virus is present in some Egyptian camels. The disease, believed to have crossed over to humans from camels, first appeared only to be passed through close contact with the animals. But recently, health workers treating people with MERS have themselves fallen ill. Cases tied to human-to-human contact have also spread to other parts of the Gulf and as far afield as Europe and Malaysia, raising concerns the virus may be either reaching a tipping point or mutating. Part of the lack of urgency on prevention may be tied to virus fatigue, scares tied to other viruses, including avian flu, which did not live up to the warnings they could mutate into more transmissible form. Much remains unknown about Middle East respiratory syndrome. Earlier this week, Saudi Health Minister Abdullah bin Abdulaziz Al-Rabiya conceded as much, even while arguing against the need for aggressive preventative measures.
Hopefully that we will reach to an idea why the surge is in April and May. Could it be that this season is the best for the virus? We don't know. We have no idea.
The next day, the minister was replaced. No reason was given, but with Saudi Arabia expecting millions of visitors in the coming months, during Ramadan in July and the Hajj in October, it's a possible sign the threat is being taken more seriously. Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, Cairo.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's coming up on 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Health Network, a multimedia network reaching 50 million Africans weekly. We bring you relevant, reliable health news and information. We ask you about the health problems most important to you and inform you about health problems impacting your community. VOA Africa Health Network. Visit our website at www.africahealthnetwork.com.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The outgoing head of the Red Cross delegation in South Sudan expresses surprise at how quickly conditions in the country are deteriorating. At least 20 people are reported dead and thousands have fled Cameroonian villages on the border with Nigeria following conflict between armed Nigerian cattle ranchers and Cameroon farmers. And female leaders in Nigeria blame the central government for failing to rescue the girls as the nation's governors meet with President Goodluck Jonathan to address a growing security crisis. Coming up, we'll have music from the DRC and our future reports. I'm Kim Lewis and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. And happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you'll be tipping off with pro basketball.
Kim, let's tip off with pro basketball and the NBA playoffs.
They're playing basketball. We love that basketball.
Remember, VOA basketball fans, during the NBA playoffs, all of the series are best of seven games, so the first club to get four wins advances. There are three first-round games later Thursday night. In the first game of the evening, the Atlanta Hawks will host the Indiana Pacers in the southern U.S. state of Georgia. This series is tied at one game each. Also in the American South, the Memphis Grizzlies are at home against the Oklahoma City Thunder. This series is also tied at 1-1. And then we go out west for the final game of the evening. It's a series between two California clubs. The Golden State Warriors, who are based in Oakland, California, will host their southern state rival, the Los Angeles Clippers. Once again, this series is tied at one game each. In first-round NBA playoff action Wednesday night, there were three more games. Let's take a look at the results. The two-time defending NBA champion Miami Heat beat the visiting Charlotte Bobcats 101-97. Miami now leads this series 2-0. Remember, VOA basketball fans, the Bobcats are the club owned by Michael Jordan. Superstar LeBron James, who has earned a few comparisons with Michael Jordan, once again led Miami on Wednesday night. LeBron scored a game-high 32 points, passed the ball for a game-high 8 assists, and also grabbed 6 rebounds. In a matchup between two clubs based in Texas, the Dallas Mavericks defeated the host San Antonio Spurs 113-92. This series is now tied at one game each. And in another game played in Texas, the Portland Trail Blazers grounded the host Houston Rockets 112-105. Portland also won the first game in Houston and leads this series 2-0.
This is Dikembe Mutombo. I am from Africa. Malaria kills thousands of children every day. Don't let your child be one of them. Make sure they sleep under a treated mosquito net. Beating malaria is like winning at basketball. You need to get to the net.
In more National Basketball Association news, Congolese giant Dikembe Mutombo, who we just heard from, presented the league's Defensive Player of the Year award to Chicago Bulls center Joakim Noah. The now-retired Mutombo was a four-time winner of the trophy, having won it in 1995, 1997, 1998, and 2001. This is the first time the 29-year-old Noah has won the Defensive Player of the Year prize. Joakim comes from some lovely and sporty stock. His mother is Cecilia Roda, a former model who was named Miss Sweden in 1978. And Joakim's father is Yannick Noah, the former French tennis star. Joakim Noah and the Bulls will be right here in Washington Friday night to play my beloved Washington Wizards in Game 3 of another first-round NBA playoff series. The magical and surprising Wizards won the first two games in Chicago. In another NBA award handed out this week, Goran Dragic of the Phoenix Suns was named the league's most improved player. Dragic plays guard, and he's from Slovenia. The 27-year-old Phoenix player averaged about 20 points and 6 assists a game this season.
Hi, I'm Segun Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports, from the Africa Service of the Voice of America. Let the games begin. We got the game.
Game on, sports fans. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. Joining us now with more sports news is our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma. And Mark's opening serve is African women's volleyball.
Defending champions Kenya Prison beat Tunisia's Sfaxien in straight sets of 25-17, 25-17 and 25-16 to qualify for the semifinals at the Africa Women's Club Volleyball Championships in the Tunisian capital Tunis on Wednesday. In other quarterfinal action, Algeria's GS Petroliers dismissed Egypt's Sham in three straight sets. Tunisia's Carthage beat Cameroon's FAP 3-1, while Kenya Pipeline dismissed Cameroon's Inges 3-1. Consequently, Kenya Prisons and Kenya Pipeline clash, while Carthage tackle GS Petroliers in semifinal action today, Thursday. Turning to football, Sudan has made several strides in recent years to uplift men's football both at club and national team competitions on the African stage. Despite many challenges, more attention is now being turned to making a breakthrough in women's football. The Sudan Football Association president, Mutasim Ghaffar Sir El Khatim, explains.
We have some difficulty there by our nature. Some people, they are talking there about the religion and how they can live. The girls play football, but now we organize two or three competitions in the University of Girls, only for girls, and also we have two, three schools. Also, we have we organize there two tournaments also there between girls only, and I think we can make breakthrough the University of Girls and these schools.
Yes. That was Mutasim Ghaffar El Khatim, Sudan Football Association president, speaking in Johannesburg, South Africa.
The Voice of America, VOA.
Morocco's preparations to stage the 2015 Orange Africa Cup of Nations is on track, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, revealed in Rabat. This follows a week-long inspection tour led by CAF's second vice president, Alamami Kamara, to scheduled host cities of Agadir, Marrakech, Tangier, and Rabat. Morocco's Youth and Sports Ministry Secretary General Karim Akwari says higher education and national education ministries have been roped in to enhance the success of staging the nation's cup. Turning to athletics, little-known 20-year-old Kenyan Cornelius Kangogo clocked 28 minutes and 15 seconds to emerge surprise winner at the Giro Lela Media Blenio 10-kilometer road race in Dongio, southern Switzerland. Kenyan Olympic 5,000-meter silver medalist Thomas Longisiwa was runner-up ahead of Ethiopia's world half-marathon silver medalist Guye Adola. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa.
I'm VOA's Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America. The world's oldest annual marathon was run for the 118th time earlier this week in the northeastern U.S. state of Massachusetts. This year's Boston Marathon was perhaps the most emotional in the long history of the race. It was held 1 year after two bombs went off near the finish line, killing three people and wounding more than 260. In the wake of the tragedy, the city adopted a simple slogan, Boston Strong, to both remember the victims and celebrate courage, leadership, and community. My friend Todd Gothberg, who completed his 16th Boston Marathon on Monday, says Boston Strong is all about a unifying spirit and strength that goes well beyond the physical traits required to finish a marathon. Todd did receive a finisher's medal in Boston. Let's listen in now to a few other runners who got a finisher's medal and tell us what it felt like.
It feels absolutely amazing. I finished last year, but I finished 20 seconds before the bombs went off. And my brother was a mile behind me, so he didn't get to finish. So it's amazing to, I didn't even have a medal put over me last year, and to have somebody place a medal on me is just awesome.
It felt absolutely incredible. When you look at the events of last year, the tragedy of last year, we earned this. We worked hard for this, and this was our year. It felt amazing.
Coming back as a survivor from the bombings last year and being able to complete it again is amazing.
Emotional day today. You know, it was really, really filled up so many times today thinking about what happened last year and just looking at this beautiful day and grateful, you know, that we could all be here. It's sad to see policemen and sad for the way we had to run the race today, but grateful that we get to run the race today.
You've been listening to a few runners who finished the 118th Boston Marathon on Monday. Finally, some more African football news. The Council for East and Central African Football Association, SACAFA, has confirmed that Ethiopia will host its 2014 Senior Challenge Cup tournament to be staged in November and December. The Ethiopians just hired a new head coach, the 57-year-old Portuguese tactician Mariano Barreto. Kenya is the defending champion in the regional SACAFA Senior Challenge Cup tournament. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on The Voice of America. Well, coming up, the South African government is close to passing new laws regarding drug patents, and the head of the African Development Bank says achieving economic progress does not depend just on having impressive numbers of GDP growth. First, let's listen to a little music. Here's Tshala Muana of the DRC with Tshilembe.
Wagunya no bulwebe, wamukashu waga ya busela,
na bintu biende ukadi ndumba mugombe. Wende ujitemba ana mwamesu abantu kuhindi bundu mwane tuku yusombe ni bakashi bilu mpunguzu mpente. Yo
Katana
Mona Chebe, Mona Linkse kukana
Kasa wambe
Shalamuwana of the DRC with Shilembe. While the South African government is close to passing new laws regarding drug patents, health activists say that could allow people to buy cheaper generic medicines. But as Emily Yulb reports, a fight may be brewing over the move.
Every day has the same ritual for Funiwe. To treat her tuberculosis, she swallows one tablet of linezolid, a patented drug that costs $63 a dose. The aid group Doctors Without Borders, one of the main advocates for patent reform in South Africa, pays for her 2 years' treatment. Doctors Without Borders argue drugs are too expensive in South Africa because laws allow too many patents to be granted to drug companies and then extended by a practice known as evergreening. That blocks the introduction of cheaper generic drugs.
Maybe they make a very small change to a medicine, and then they get a completely new patent on the same medicine, and they can continue to block generic competition for another 20 years.
Given a monopoly, pharmaceutical companies tend to keep drug prices high to recoup development costs and increase profits. Under the proposed intellectual property reform bill, the process to grant new patents for existing medicine would get tougher scrutiny and, in theory, would lead to fewer patents being extended. But intellectual property attorney André van der Merwe says implementing a new system would be challenging.
In order to examine those applications,
You need teams of technical examiners, which South Africa doesn't have, and we would struggle to find those. Once you start requiring examination, the process becomes longer and it's more expensive, and someone's got to pay these people to do that work.
Generic drug producer Paul Enley, the CEO of Pharmadynamics, argues that evergreening costs South Africans.
The litigation cost in attempting to revoke a patent runs into many, many millions of rands. It's a process that can take up to 4 years, and that delays generic launch and denies access to those generic products to the population.
A few weeks ago, leaked documents show some pharmaceutical companies planned a secret campaign to lobby against the reform. The leak caused an uproar, with South African Health Minister Aaron Motsoaledi saying the plan is of satanic magnitude.
When there are clandestine lobbying mechanisms, secret, which want to subvert the democratic process, one has to get very angry. We are a sovereign state, we have got to make laws. And if the laws are challenged, they must be challenged openly in the public arena.
Motsoaledi says reform is a must in his country and throughout Africa, especially for AIDS patients who need antiretroviral drugs.
Of the 8 million people worldwide who are on ARVs, 6 million are in sub-Saharan Africa, and 80% of them depend on generics from India. If it was not generics from India, we wouldn't be able as Africa to treat so many people.
The reform would also allow the government to override patents when a drug is deemed too expensive. But that may also be a disincentive for companies to invest in developing new life-saving medications. Emily Yob for VOA News, Johannesburg.
The head of the African Development Bank, Donald Kaburuka, says achieving economic progress does not depend just on having impressive numbers of GDP growth, high-rise buildings, or first-class highways. He says development institutions like the African Development Bank looking to promote growth must also consider political factors. VOA's Miriama Diallo reports.
When recent fighting erupted in South Sudan, the African Development Bank had just approved a $25 million electricity project. Neither bank president Donald Kaburuka nor his staff saw the conflict coming.
Someone back to my staff is it, what is it that we not understand?
Kaburuka says when conflicts erupt in countries, the bank's financing of development projects has to start all over again.
We need to finance the development in Somalia. We beat roads. We beat hospitals, but the country went back into shambles. I had an office in Bangui. We had just opened office in Juba. But when you go back to square one, I'll be going further than my traditional mandate of economics and development, looking closely at the political economy of the country.
In a recent report of the so-called fragile states of Africa, Kaburuka said bank managers have not taken political risks into account when making development decisions.
We concluded that fragility is a big risk for Africa. We looked at stable countries, hitherto stable countries, which suddenly erupt, either because of a bad election, because of corruption. And you found that each one of our countries is at risk. And by extension, Africa's own prosperity at the moment is at risk.
That sustainable development cannot be achieved without security was one of the key themes of the EU-Africa summit that took place recently in Brussels. Since 2004, the EU has provided more than $1.6 billion to support peacekeeping missions like AMISOM in Somalia and MISCA in the Central African Republic. EU institutions have also pledged over $38 billion for development assistance for Africa in the next 7 years. Andris Piebalgs, the EU Commissioner for Development, says 70% of those funds will go to less developed nations based on specific criteria, including a measure of per capita income.
So that means if country has, is more richer, it gets less. I would just give example, Gabon. The second is vulnerability. It means the country is more landlocked or some structural weaknesses that also gets more.
The commissioner also says that some countries are doing better.
I would take Ethiopia or Rwanda, where basically our support managed to bring countries to new level of development. It's still very poor countries. But you see that they are moving. Are there risks? Yes, they are. But I think in this politics, no one is safe.
In Washington, Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer Bill Workinger and our engineer Skip Sisk, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
An editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In an important step toward restoring stability in the Central African Republic, the United Nations Security Council voted to authorize creating an international peacekeeping force to be deployed there. The contingent, numbering up to 12,000 troops, police, and corrections officers, will assume authority in September, building on the security gains made by African Union and French forces already in the country. Bringing more security to the CAR is urgently needed to end the interreligious fighting that has torn the nation apart and created a humanitarian crisis. Sources of the conflict are many, but much of the fighting has taken on a sectarian character as anti-Balaka militias began attacking Muslim civilians in retaliation for Seleka rebel abuses. The violence has caused tens of thousands to flee their homes in the capital Bangui and the western half of the country. In Bangui this month, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Samantha Power and Africa Affairs Assistant Secretary Linda Thomas-Greenfield met with the CAR's transitional president, Catherine Samba Panza. Taking office in late January, President Samba Panza has worked tirelessly under extremely difficult conditions, and Ambassador Power assured her of our nation's continued commitment to helping her government and the people of her country. As AU MISCA forces transitions to a UN peacekeeping operation, or UNPKO, the United States will continue working with others in the international community to ensure that the AU troop-contributing countries, French, and soon-to-arrive European Union forces have the support they need to mitigate the violence and the humanitarian challenges facing the people of the CAR right now.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, voanews.com/editorials.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.